It's easy to take our bodies for granted until something goes wrong, and then we learn a lot more about tendons and keratosis and the proper stretching of the piriformis. We'll get a tour of the body today, but not as if from an anatomy textbook. Dr. Gavin Francis takes more of a tour guide approach in his book, Adventures in Human Being, A Grand Tour from the Cranium to the Calcaneum. Gavin Francis is a doctor who writes, to use his own terminology. He's written books about the Arctic and Antarctic. His book on Antarctica won the prize for Scottish Book of the Year, so now you know where he's from, too. Dr. Francis lives in the Scottish capital, Edinburgh, and joins us by phone from there. Dr. Francis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Jeff.
So the tour aspect of the book certainly makes sense in the sense that you say you wanted to be a geographer. What happened to that ambition?
When I was a boy, I wanted very much to study geography. I was fascinated by maps, and I thought that being a geographer would give me a skill that I could earn a living, but also help me understand more about the world around me. But when I was a teenager, somebody gave me an atlas of anatomy, and I switched allegiances because the atlas of anatomy seemed to me even more enthralling, really. Understanding our bodies beneath the skin seemed to me to be something that could provide a fascination that would keep me going through 40 or 50-year career. So, yeah, I switched.
Was it really called the Atlas of Anatomy?
Yeah, it was just called an Atlas of Anatomy for, I think it was for nursing students, actually, the one that I got hold of when I was a teenager.
All right, so you're not the first person to compare the human body to the larger world or universe.
Yeah, absolutely, and that was a very ancient Greek idea as well, you know, the old ideas that our body was in balance and it, the environment around us has a huge impact on our health, which of course now we know to be true.
Dr. Francis, it apparently took you a while to settle on what kind of medicine you'd practice. Tell us about the search for a specialty.
Yeah, well, when I first qualified in medicine in 1999, I worked in emergency medicine. So I did a lot of ER work and worked in small hospitals in the Highlands of Scotland and in big trauma units. And then I decided to take a sidestep to go into expedition medicine. So then I went off to Antarctica for a year and a half as the expedition doctor for the British Antarctic Survey. I lived there for a while and also did some expeditions in the Arctic. And my first, as you mentioned, my first two books are about the Arctic and the Antarctic. Then I did some surgical training. I did neurosurgery for a while and then some general surgery, and then I became an obstetrician, learned about delivering babies and so on, and then I worked in the tropics for a while, and finally I went back to becoming a family physician in the city centre. Every specialty I tried, I felt I was missing something. I was missing something about the stories of people's lives. I was missing something by becoming over-specialised. And I love the generalism of being a family physician, the fact that I see people from the age of one day to 101, and I know whole families. They're all registered with me, and I see whole families through rocky patches of their lives. That, for me, is much more deeply satisfying than any of those hospital specialties that I did.
So you didn't want to narrow your focus either in age range or in part of the body.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I realized as well early on that I wasn't interested enough in diseases to want to specialize in one or two of them. I was always much more interested in people and their stories, and so it was quite natural for me to stick with the most general specialties.
Well, the book Adventures in Human Being certainly is full of stories. Tell us about how the book is organized.
Well, the book is a set of chapters that takes you from the head to the toe, really. It's 18 chapters. The first two chapters are about the brain, and the first chapter is about neurosurgery. It's about my time as a trainee in that specialty and doing one of these operations when the patient's brain is exposed and then they're woken up. And so they're actually operated with an exposed brain while able to talk to the surgeon who's doing the operating, which is an incredible insight into the ideas that we have about our sense of self and where our self is. The second chapter about the brain is more about psychiatry and about my experiences working in the psychiatric hospital here, and specifically about electroconvulsive therapy, a still very controversial treatment. And then it moves all the way down through the face and the chest, the heart, the lungs, and all the way down to the toes. And each chapter tries to take a much more broad perspective than just one from the clinic. It tries to explore cultural and artistic and philosophical interpretations and explanations of the body.
So it's not sequential in the sense that you have to read the book in order. If you wanted to start at the toes and go to the brain, you could do that too.
Yeah, you can read it. And I say that in the introduction, read it in any order. The system of examining the body, doctors of course have a very kind of rigorous system whereby they go about examining the body, and they usually do it head to toe, and as do pathologists when they're doing autopsies. But you can read it any way you like.
So we'll take a short break now and come back and talk more with Dr. Gavin Francis. He's the author of the book Adventures in Human Being, a grand tour from the cranium to the calcaneum. It truly is a top-to-bottom look at the human body and a comparison to an atlas or a tour guide, in a sense. So we'll come back and talk more with Dr. Gavin Francis. If you have some questions or comments you'd like to relate to him about things in the human body, we're more than welcome to take those. 800-838-3760 on the telephone. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Back to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Gavin Francis, Adventures in Human Being, and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the Scottish physician, Dr. Gavin Francis. He has written a book called Adventures in Human Being, a grand tour from the cranium to the calcaneum, so literally top to bottom in the human body. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about all the great structures in there and some of the great stories Dr. Francis has collected about them. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Gavin, in the chapter about the brain, this is fun. Tell us about your first time actually holding a human brain in your hands.
That chapter, yes, it starts in second year of medical school in neuroanatomy class when I was just 19 years old. In the UK, you don't need to have a degree before you study medicine, so you can start at the age of 18. And so I was 19 starting neuroanatomy when I first was given a bucket with a human brain in it. And it was the most incredible privilege, a tremendous privilege, really, to be given this opportunity to learn about the human brain. I remember one of my dissection mates in the anatomy class had studied philosophy before she switched to medicine, and she said to me, "Give me that brain, you know, I want to hold it in my hands." I said, "What do you need it for?" And she says, "I need to see the seat of the soul, the pineal gland." And of course, there was an old Renaissance idea that there actually was a particular seat of the soul within the brain, which is a small gland we now know that regulates sleep and wakefulness. It regulates whether or not we can dream and in many ways. And so that's what the ancients thought was the seat of the soul.
It's interesting, though, to think about them thinking of this as the seat of the soul. It's a fairly small structure. And I don't know, it's just kind of strange to think that the things that make us can reside. And I know it doesn't, in fact, but I mean, just the brain is not that big, and yet it's so much of what we are.
Incredible, really, and as every year goes by, neurobiology is turning up more and more astonishing ideas about just how we experience the world around us. You know, recently they've been showing that when we see somebody suffering or in pain, when we see somebody receiving a wound or a cut, the same parts of our brain are active as if we ourselves were receiving that cut. So we empathize with our brains as well as experience with our brains in much the same way. And every year that goes by, we're discovering new things about different kinds of behaviors, whether it's attention deficit behaviors or things about autism. And we're finding more and more that the ways we live and the way we experience the world has visible effects on our brains.
We talked about empathy in a larger discussion about just that one subject earlier this week, and got into the discussion of mirror neurons, and it seems like we can't get into a discussion of the brain lately without hitting on that.
Yeah.
That's a big one, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And these mirror neurons... neurons that seem to be active at the same time as things that we witness happening, as if we were experiencing them ourselves. There's a class of neurons that have been discovered that seem to convey that kind of empathy. They're called von Economo neurons, and people are starting to examine these neurons that seem to mix together our own imaginations of what somebody must be experiencing with the way our brains would respond themselves to being in pain. It's incredible stuff.
Gavin, you mentioned the surgery where they had to wake the patient up to be sure they weren't damaging speech centers, and the surgeon referred to the eloquent brain. What did he mean?
Yeah, eloquent brain is the term that the neurosurgeons use to describe that part of the brain which is responsible for articulating speech. And so, in a certain sense, there are sections of your brain that are themselves eloquent. If they're damaged, you can no longer articulate your ideas. And so it's an amazing thought that although when you look at a brain in the operating theater or even in the autopsy suite, the surface of the brain looks the same. Wherever you look, it looks very, very similar. And yet there are tiny portions of it, just millimeters wide, that have absolutely crucial functions, and if they're damaged, we lose those functions, such as the ability to articulate our speech.
And the distance is really millimeters, so the difference between speaking and mute is just that small.
Yeah, absolutely. That particular chapter describes the case of a patient I knew who had terrible epilepsy, very intractable epilepsy, and the seizures kept on coming despite all the best maximized, optimized medications. And so she opted to try to have the focus of those seizures removed, cut out by the surgeon. And that's why she needed to be woken up, so that we wouldn't go anywhere near those eloquent areas of brain while we were operating.
Wow, that's amazing stuff. We're talking about The Human Body in Adventures in Human Being, the book by Gavin Francis here on the Jefferson Exchange. You mentioned earlier ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, or shock treatment. I mean, I guess I'm surprised this still goes on. What does it do?
Yeah, and it's used a lot less than it used to be, thankfully. I mean, there's no doubt now that through the 60s and the 70s, that particular treatment was overused. And it's estimated now, particularly in the States, it's estimated that it's used about a third less often than it used to be in the 60s and 70s, so significantly less. And I think part of the reason for that is because we recognize that although in some very selected instances it can be very, very helpful, on the other hand, it can have far-reaching side effects. You know, it can cause a lot of memory loss. Some people feel that episodes of electroconvulsive therapy were quite harmful for them rather than beneficial, and so its use is much, much more tightly controlled nowadays than it used to be, and thankfully so. But I have seen it used, it's such a controversial treatment, but I have seen it used in instances where people were essentially fading away, starving themselves to death through very, very profound depression, and ECT has brought them back to life. And those individuals swear by it, but that's not in any way to detract from the fact that some people feel it's been harmful for them and they wish that they'd never had it. It's very complicated, very controversial.
We had a caller question already about in the section about the brain, about if there's any particular meaning to having very vivid, very colorful dreams.
Well, dreams remain a real mystery, and the masterwork on dreams, of course, was by Sigmund Freud wrote some fabulous interpretation work of dreams, where a lot of modern psychiatrists tend to think that our dreams are kind of irrelevant, that they're just froth on the top of our brains. They're just side effects of our brains resting through the night. But I have noticed patients, I have known people whose dreams, who have recurrent, persistent, distressing dreams, and though I'm not a psychoanalyst, often just discussing them with me, just a relatively untrained in psychiatry, a family physician, we can find themes and anxieties and fears that persistently have troubled the individual, and so it can be helpful. I think some people process dreams much more vividly than others, probably just because of natural variation and the fact that their brains are are very subtly different from people that tend to forget them. But there's no doubt that although the scientific basis of Freudian dream interpretation is now questioned, that they can still have value. Thinking about them and thinking about the themes in them can still have value and tell us things about our lives.
Is that an admonition not to just go, bah, it means nothing, it was a dream?
Yeah, and I think for some people, that's the right thing to do, just to say, ah, it doesn't mean anything. But then there's some people where, for example, if they've had a particularly traumatic experience in childhood, or they're having a particularly problematic relationship with their family, if they're having the same recurrent dream over and over again, then it's fruitful to try and unpick that and talk to that individual about why that might be. They can really be illuminating in that way.
The book, again, is called Adventures in Human Being, A Grand Tour from the Cranium to the Calcaneum. Dr. Gavin Francis in Scotland wrote the book, and he's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. And you can join the discussion at 800-838-3760 on the phone, jx@jeffnet.org by email. Dr. Francis, do you often marvel at the distance we've traveled in curing humans and the distance that still lies ahead of us?
Yeah, absolutely. We have, in the last century, in the West, doubled the life expectancy of humanity. I mean, that's absolutely unbelievable. We have doubled the length of time that we can live, on average. But at the same time, that's come with immense costs, of course, and sometimes I wonder, there are, of course, very much cheaper, widespread, available health interventions we could make all over the world, which would have very quick benefits. But Western medicine has done just amazing, astonishing things, but there's so much still to be done. There's so many cancers we don't know how to treat. There's so many particularly immunological problems, you know, like rheumatoid arthritis or multiple sclerosis, that we still can't treat very effectively. There's still a great deal that we can, that is still out there to be learned about and to be uncovered.
We move from the brain to the eye. You say you can see entire worlds just in the eyeball. What's in there?
Well, when I examine my patients in my clinic in Edinburgh, I usually do it by daylight. There's a large window, but the exception is they have a problem with their eyes, and then I have to close the blinds and switch off all the lights and examine that eye in darkness using a tiny little telescope called an ophthalmoscope. And when I look inside my patient's eyes, at the back wall of their eyes on the retina, I sometimes see sights like... You can see pale, fluffy spots caused by diabetes, and they look a little bit like cumulus clouds. Or sometimes, if there's a thrombosis of one of the veins, you can see this sort of glorious scarlet flood of color, and it looks a bit like a sunset. And it's actually called that in the textbooks. They call it stormy sunset appearance.
Wow.
And so when you look into the vault of a patient's eyeball, sometimes it feels a little bit like looking up at the sky. And the history that I try to go through in that chapter of how we came to learn about the eye is amazing. It wasn't doctors who discovered how the eye works. It was astronomers. Back in the 17th century, astronomers were starting to figure out the heavens, people like Isaac Newton, and they realized they couldn't understand what they were seeing unless they, first of all, managed to understand how the eye works. So it was they who figured out that it was the retina that did the seeing, not the lens. It wasn't doctors at all. It was astronomers.
That's amazing. I never realized that they were that influential in that. My eyes watered just reading about the performance of cataract surgery, which raises the question, how do surgeons do that?
I think it's just you get numb after a while. You just sticking sharp knives into vulnerable parts of people's bodies just becomes so routine for them that they don't even flinch. You know, this morning I was with a colleague in an autopsy room here in Edinburgh, and just seeing the way that she handles human organs, human tissue, because she still has the appropriate degree of respect for doing it, but she's so consummate and professional and so habituated to it that she doesn't even flinch anymore. And it always amazes me to be with surgeons and see the way that they decisively just cut down and slit people open. Yeah, it's a few years since I did any surgical training, so yeah.
Yeah, it takes a special kind of person to be able to cut open another person. I've come to appreciate that over the years.
Yeah, I think so.
So moving on to the face now, and you mentioned that studying cadaver faces, you noted things about what expressions do to faces long term.
Yeah, I mean, I used to, when I was at medical school, I paid my way through that time at university by working as an anatomy tutor and demonstrator. And so I used to prepare an awful lot of cadavers for teaching. So I used to spend my spare time up in the anatomy department, sometimes revealing things beneath the surface of the skin in order to show other students what was there. And so I have seen under the skin of an awful lot of faces in my time. And one thing I really noticed was the variation in the muscle strength. You know, some people have great big smiling muscles, indicating that they probably had a life filled with laughter and great humor. Sometimes I would be revealing the muscles beneath the skin of the face and see that somebody seemed to have spent most of their time frowning because their smiling muscles were very withered, but their frowning muscles were enlarged. And it's incredible to think that how we live our lives leaves a trace on our bodies. It writes itself onto our bodies in that way.
Wow, it really does stamp itself in there for sure. The book is called Adventures in a Human Being, A Grand Tour from the Cranium to the Calcaneum. Gavin Francis, its author, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. And you point out when you're talking about the face too, Gavin, that when someone loses feeling in the face, it's more than a medical issue. It's about being able to express themselves.
Yeah, that's right. And in that chapter, I explore Bell's palsy, which is paralysis of one half of the face, one half of the facial expression muscles. And people find that extraordinarily disabling, not just because of the appearance and how we're so used to seeing symmetrical faces when we walk around, but also that it becomes difficult to express kind of joy or even anger or anything at all, really, when half of your face won't work. People who suffer Parkinson's disease often tell me that too, where they find it difficult to express all of the muscles of facial expression. They often say that one of the hardest things is that in company, people don't know whether they're laughing or frowning because their faces don't respond anymore in the way that they used to. And people find that one of the most disabling aspects of facial problems.
Wow. And when you stop to think about, it's facial muscles, big deal. But the fact is, it is a very big deal for the people who own those muscles.
Yeah. I mean, as we move around through society as human beings, we're constantly scanning everybody's faces around us. And we're very good at reading between the lines and reading the intentions of other people that we meet through their facial expressions. And we learn that from a very young age. You know, if you look at newborn babies, they will zoom in on faces that are coming towards them even before they can properly focus. So faces are the most interesting parts of the world around us for many human beings. And when we can't adequately communicate with those facial expressions, that can be very disabling.
Now we move on to the inner ear and balance. What is the Epley maneuver and how much work did it take to come up with it?
Well, it's wonderful to be speaking on Oregon radio because I'm sure Epley at one point worked in Oregon. Epley is an American otolaryngologist who figured out in the 80s that severe incapacitating episodes of vertigo. This is when this isn't the fear of heights vertigo. This is medical vertigo when you feel as if the room is spinning, even when it's not. So some people suffer from those incapacitating episodes of vertigo if they move their head in a certain position. And they used to have major operations done on the nerve that conveys balance. But Epley realized that just by putting the head through a sequence of physical therapy moves, he could cure this problem without any drugs, without any surgery at all. And it was a revolution, really, in the treatment of vertigo. You know, 2,500 years ago, ancient Greek texts talked about the difficulty of treating vertigo, and Epley figured it out just in the 1980s. And it's a maneuver, the Epley maneuver. It's something I use regularly, even in my clinic in Scotland.
I see Dr. John Epley is, in fact, still practicing in Portland.
Yeah. Well, hats off to John Epley. He is, he's great. He was also one of the pioneers of cochlear implants back in the 60s. I read when I was reading into the backstory of those amazing devices. And so Yeah, everybody, hats off to John Epley, and I'm glad to hear he's still practicing. That's amazing.
He's still got an office open on 7th Avenue in Portland. But, yeah, we'll talk more about other features of the human body as described in the sense of a tour by Gavin Francis in his book Adventures in Human Being, a grand tour from the cranium to the calcaneum. We'll come back and talk more with Gavin Francis, and you can join us as well at 800-838-3760 on the phone, jx@jeffnet.org by email. Back to the Jefferson Exchange and the human body and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're taking a tour of the human body today with Dr. Gavin Francis in Edinburgh, Scotland, the author of the book Adventures in Human Being, a grand tour from the cranium to the calcaneum. Join the tour with your questions and comments, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Gavin, you compare the lungs to the leaves on a tree. Give us that analogy.
Well, the lungs, in terms of their tissue, are remarkably like leaves in the sense that what leaves do is they draw in carbon dioxide and they leak the gas oxygen. So that's how they keep our atmosphere healthy. And lungs do the opposite, of course. They draw in oxygen to keep us alive and they leak out carbon dioxide. So in a sense, in their function, they're very, very similar to leaves in reverse. But they also, the structure of them, when you look at them, when you look at the trachea, the windpipe, and the large airways of the lungs, they look very much like trees and branches. And in fact, when pathologists are classifying problems with the lung, they talk about the bronchial tree and which part of the bronchial tree is diseased. So whenever I think about lungs, I think about lightness and the free motion of air, but I also think about trees and leaves and how, in a sense, our lungs are kind of like branches and leaves that we carry within us that keep us alive.
The lightness of it, I guess, struck me in your description of it too, that the fact that they are just such lightweight things and
yeah,
so important.
Yeah, so lightweight. They're full of air, or they should be. As long as you don't have pneumonia.
Right. I'm struck by the story of a patient you had with lung cancer, a man who apparently railed at you quite a bit about cigarettes.
I know. Well, I... You know, I usually advise my patients not to smoke cigarettes, particularly if they've got lung trouble. And yeah, he certainly anticipated that coming. So I describe how he would wag his nicotine-stained finger at me and tell me that he wasn't about to give up smoking.
Let's take a momentary aside then. And so what is the number one behavior of patients you'd like to change? Is it smoking?
Probably not, actually. The number one behavior I would like people to change is to take more exercise, because we're surrounded in modern life by so many fabulous labor-saving devices. So many, you know, we've got such wonderful cars and great public transport, and we've got these machines that help us do everything. And actually, it means that our bodies, which were evolved to work, and our muscles were evolved to move. We don't move the way that we used to and that we should in order to keep our bodies healthy. You know, there's good evidence that even just doing half an hour of exercise a day, and by exercise I mean enough to get you slightly out of breath. You have to get out of breath. There's evidence that just doing that is better for your mental health than taking Prozac or any of those drugs. You know, just that exercising regularly every day is really good for your physical health, it's really good for your mental health. And so if I could do one thing, it would be to get everybody to do some exercise every day, just enough to get them a little bit out of breath.
Slightly out of breath means you don't have to stop and bend over, but you're breathing a little harder anyway?
Yeah, you're breathing a bit harder. So for some people, you know, who are very fit, to get out of breath, they've really got to work at it. You know, they would have to jog or run. Some other people, getting out of breath just means, you know, just climbing a flight of stairs instead of taking the elevator. And so there's many things that we can do at all levels of fitness. You know, you can never be too unfit to start doing some kinds of exercise, and you will benefit from it. Your body will benefit from it, and your mind will benefit from it.
So, and then, of course, you're going to go listen to somebody's heart to see how well the exercise is doing. So when we get to the heart in the book, you talk about listening with a stethoscope. What else do you hear besides the beating?
Well, sometimes I hear murmurs, of course. Murmurs are caused by the turbulence of blood flowing through slightly narrowed or obstructed chambers in the heart. And, you know, one of my patients has a quite a pronounced heart murmur, and I was explaining about how murmurs can often be beautiful. The sound can be actually quite beautiful. And she said, I never thought of it that way. I thought it was just a disease. But no, the sounds of them can actually be quite lovely and almost musical. And when I listen to the heart, I'm listening for all those kinds of sounds. Similarly, when you listen to the lungs, you want to hear nice, free, floating movement of breath, but also sometimes you can hear the sound of fluid buildup or infection or inflammation on the lining of the lung.
How long did it take in medical school before you realized what you were listening for and got used to noticing the differences?
Yeah, well, I mean, for murmurs, I used to have a CD of heart murmurs. So I used to be sitting there studying at my desk in my apartment with a CD playing in the background, and I'm telling you all the different murmurs, aortic stenosis, mitral regurgitation, etc., etc. And that was how I learned to use them. But also, I was trained in medicine in a very kind of old-fashioned, traditional way of just big, long, open wards where the cardiologists would line up patients that had particularly obvious or interesting physical signs. A bit like the way, you know, the great physician Osler, American physician, used to teach. And mm-hmm. we would move down these procession of patients listening to their different murmurs and listening to their different lung sounds.
I hope your roommates never took the wrong CDs to parties and things. And
yeah, exactly. You can get a dance remix of cardiac murmurs.
Gavin, what is the condition known as pump head?
Pump head is a mental condition, really, that can arise in up to a third of people who come off heart-lung bypass machines. So if you've ever had open-heart surgery, like a bypass graft or a valve replacement, you will have spent time on a cardiac bypass machine. So the heart is stopped and the blood is piped out of the body into another machine which takes over the oxygenation and the pumping. And they discovered in the 70s, when these machines began to be used, that quite often people had problems with their mood and with their memory. Their thinking was often clouded, a bit muddled when they came round from these machines, and nobody really knew why. But it's been given this term, pump head, to describe that kind of change in mood that can come over you.
Does it pass after a period of time?
Yeah, in most people it passes within a matter of days or weeks, but some people it can persist quite a while.
And does medicine know what specifically causes it?
Not really. There's different theories that it's to do with the tiny bubbles of air which get into your bloodstream through these machines. There's also theories that cutting the aorta, the big artery in the body, cutting that in order to pump the blood out, sends kind of scatter guns of tiny little particles up into the brain that can disorder your mood. But some people, and this is what I explore specifically in that chapter, some people think this to do with the fact that our brains are hardwired to have a pulsatile flow of blood, that our blood should come to the brain in pulses, just the way the heart beats it. And if your blood is pumped instead by a steady, constant flow through a machine, your brain doesn't like that, and your thinking alters to reflect that.
So it flows like a river while we're hooked up to the machine?
Yeah, so they do have machines now that have a pulsatile flow to them, but even the best machines can't mimic the pressure pulse of a beating human heart. Mm. And so they still have an aspect of them which is more like a river flow rather than like a pump and surge flow.
Wow, that's an amazing story. You do spend some time on breasts in this book. How common is breast cancer?
Yeah, I mean, breast cancer is the commonest cancer, actually, in Western populations. And so I see an enormous amount of breast cancer, and most family doctors will have several women at any one time that are undergoing treatment for it. So it's something that I see a great deal of, yeah.
The poet, you mentioned the poet Kathleen Jamie in the book. She had a mastectomy and used it as an inspiration. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, this particular poet's poet had had treatment that she described in a book called Frischer, and she felt at the end of her treatment and her mastectomy and so on that doctors had been staring at her scar an awful lot, and she wanted a different kind of perspective on healing. And so she decided, instead of showing off the scar to doctors, she would show it to an artist. And she sat for a series of portraits of the scar, quite beautiful portraits that were done just of the scar, the line of the scar that it made. And she wrote short prose poems to go with each one. And she explains really beautifully in the book how it might seem like an odd thing to do or a slightly macabre thing to do, but for her it was about healing and about imagining her body and the transformation that her body had gone through in a new way, and linking the change that had happened to her body with the much wider changes we see in the world around us all the time in terms of the seasonal changes and the survival of different species around her. So that book and the exhibition that went with it gave me a new kind of perspective on healing, different from the medical, very clinical perspective on what constitutes healing. And it's a good reminder for me that what healing really is different for every person.
Well, and I'm struck too by the knowledge. We did a bit of work recently about disabled veterans, and so obviously amputees and the bunch. But just how people's image can change greatly in some cases, and not very much at all in others.
Yeah.
When body parts are lost.
Yeah, there's different people have different kind of resiliences to these things, to do with their own body image and to do with their background and to do with how much care and support they have around them, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You get into the shoulder in the book, and you tell us that Homer's Iliad can teach us a few things about shoulder injuries. Like what?
Well, Homer's Iliad, of course, is one of these foundational texts of Western literature. It's a very ancient text, and it's nearly 3,000 years old itself, and it's thought to describe events that are 1,000 years older than that. But there's some beautiful descriptions in it of injuries that I have seen and recognized immediately from the emergency room. So, for example, there's an account in part of the Iliad where it describes Hector, there's a Trojan prince, throwing a rock at one of the Greek master archers, a guy called Teucer. And he throws this boulder at Teucer, who at the time is using his bow and arrows to kill a whole load of Trojans. So Hector throws this rock and it hits Teucer on the shoulder, right on the collarbone. And it describes beautifully in the Iliad how the archer's arm drops to his side limp and he drops the bow and he loses all power in that arm. And he has to be dragged off the battlefield. And that is an injury called a brachial stun that I've seen in the emergency department. And I describe an account of a veteran of Afghanistan having exactly that injury, caused not through a Trojan rock being thrown at him, of course, but through coming off his motorcycle.
Wow. So there are a lot of things in the shoulder that can go wrong, and I'm sure, you know, American baseball pitchers seem to learn this all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly complicated joint. The fabulous Renaissance artist Da Vinci, Leonardo da Vinci, was fascinated by the shoulder, and many of his best anatomical drawings are about the shoulder because he was so enthralled by the way that it works. It's so delicate and yet so strong.
So, which brings up a question that outside of the brain, and of course the shoulder would be a candidate now, what is the most complicated part of the body to navigate, to work in, to diagnose difficulty with?
Oh, I don't know. There's so many. And nowadays, the diagnostic difficulties are all in the molecular things, so right down to the level of the molecule. And now we're getting this personalized medicine coming in where people are actually having their DNA sequence checked by labs so that we can target specific treatments. So we know now that certain kinds of treatment only work if you have a particular kind of DNA sequence. And so the complexity of that kind of medicine, which is only just coming in, it's the most modern and up-to-date medicine there is quite astounding, really. And there's complex parts of the body all over. I mean, I remember being surprised as a student when I was told by the neurosurgeons that actually the most fine, meticulous surgical procedures tend to be done by the plastic surgeons. You know, when they reattach a finger or something like that, they have to use more high-powered delicacy in terms of re-stitching nerves and re-stitching blood vessels than the neurosurgeons were using. And so, you know, there's as much complexity in your finger as there is in your brain.
Well, let's finish up talking about knees and feet together. I mean, are we doing our bodies a disservice by walking upright?
Well, walking upright is certainly bad for our backs. I think that, like most physicians, I see an enormous amount of back pain. So many people in our culture have bad back pain, and it's partly to do with the fact that our backs aren't strong and fit, and it's partly to do with unavoidable problems of walking upright. But, you know, walking upright has freed our hands and our brains to make sense of the world, and we wouldn't be human, and we wouldn't have made all these advances over the past 10,000 years as a culture if we didn't walk upright. So it's a mixed blessing.
True. So we're better off not using our hands for propulsion at this point. So much we've learned in the book. It's called Adventures in Human Being, a grand tour from the cranium to the calcaneum. Gavin Francis wrote it and joined us on The Exchange today. Dr. Francis, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
Good to talk to you.